1.5 line six, line 2.12 in the bill. They had 1.5 cents. This is the 13 bill, the 2013. And on line 2.14, they had a half a cent. So the purpose of the bill is to combine those two to get the uses correct. To combine, City of Cook isn't getting one single more dollar, not a penny. I have unanimous support by the Range delegation, which you probably should put that in some journal. except that, Mr. Chairman, I
March 5th today, 2014?
Yep. So there is an amendment that you can't adopt, obviously, until you have a quorum. It changes some lines on, it changes a couple of lines down here on line 2.15 and 2.17.
You know, the chair is tempted to not adopt the amendment.
Who didn't?
The chair is tempted to not adopt the amendment.
Well,
leave the bill as currently drafted.
I think that that's an excellent idea because as I look at the bill, it says in the lines that I'm trying to amend, it says 2.0 cents per ton. That's times 40 million tons, right?
Starts to be
but
go
if you
money.
Look down in Representative Rukavina's district, where he's constantly saying that Senator Bach and I are taking his money, if you'll remember those many discussions here, it says simply for the city of Keewatin, which is Representative Moline, it says 0.5 cents. So they should have only got a half a cent. I think that's appropriate.
You know, Representative Dill, you may not be aware that it costs the United States Mint 1.8 cents to mint penny. So when we're talking half a cent,
0.9.
Yeah. 0.9. Representative Hertas's math is good. All right.
So anyway, I view the bill, I mean, I think the bill is non-controversial. The city requested it, and no rangers. This is all range dollars and no range opposition.
All right. Any questions from committee members? Representative Torkelson.
Well, I'm wondering what the author has against the city of Virginia. If you look on line 2.19, it looks to me like they're getting 3.3 cents.
The question is, again, sir?
Representative Torkelson, Representative
Gill. Oh, he does them both. Oh, I'm sorry.
There we go. The amendment covers it.
Carefully, and I beg your forgiveness. I heard him talking about Keewatin, and I thought he was ignoring the poor city of Virginia.
Well, I'm not.
Representative Gill.
I mean, Mr. Chairman, all of those are Representative Rukavina's district, and I'm going to be calling him, telling him that he was only getting 3.3 cents, not 3.3 cents per ton. He'll probably charter a jet down here to straighten it out.
You know, Representative Dill, you're reminding me of the old neighborhood where the house on the corner was still the Johnson's house 20 years after they moved out.
Yep.
And it's apparently going to be Representative Rukavina's district for a number of years.
Yep. So anyway, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Right.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify regarding House File 2426? Seeing none, thank you very much for visiting the Property Tax Committee. We will formally move the bill and the amendment when we have a quorum.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Next up, Representative Purcell. For those in the audience looking at the agenda, out of courtesy to those not members of the committee, we are moving Representative Lean's House File 2465 to the end of the agenda and appreciate his courtesy there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before you today, it's file 2261, mm-hmm. And would have liked that for consideration. Just a little bit about the bill, Mr. Chairman and members. This bill is brought to me through former Representative Creasel, who's now a County Veteran Service Officer up in Noak County, and we've got another County Veteran Service Officer that would like to say a couple of words about this. But it, as you can read, this is... This is aimed at 70% disabled vet or greater disability.
What?
I'm sorry, 100. I might screw it up here. I might have to let some do it better for me. But that we're going to extend that that homestead credit, which now sunsets at 5 years after a veteran has passed. So I'm going to. If I may get the explanation that I know is going to be right on the money if you'd allow former Representative Kreisel to speak to this.
Representative Kreisel, welcome back to the Minnesota House. Good to see a friendly face. Please introduce yourself for the tape and then proceed with your testimony, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is John Kreisel. I'm the Director of Veteran Services for Anoka County and on the Legislative Committee for the Minnesota Association of County Veteran Service Officers. House File 2261, what it would do, current law allows any veteran that is 100% permanent and totally disabled to have up to $300,000 of their homestead market value of their home to be excluded from property taxes. If they pass away, their spouse, that benefit continues for their spouse for the current tax year plus five additional years. What this bill would do would eliminate that five-year limit to it. So this way, when a 100% service-connected veteran dies, passes away, that's a reduction in household income, which causes drain on that surviving spouse. And then in addition to that, after that 5 years, they would have to then pay that the property tax. So it is that is how it works. I would be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Representative Carlson.
Chairman, I mean, this is more a curiosity question because my father was a World War II vet and had a disability until he died. But his disability would change periodically. He would be at a certain rate. I don't know. I don't remember if he was ever at 100%. I think he might have been right after the war. But then his problems would recur sometimes a few years later. Over time, that would be dropped down. And then if he was hospitalized, then it would go back up to the high mark. So I'm just curious how this works with a veteran whose disability compensation, at least, fluctuates over time.
Citizen Kreisel.
I think he was as low as 60% and may have been at some time as high as 100.
Okay.
And I don't know if they treat veterans the same way today or not, because that was World War II.
Mr. Kreisel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, as the disability rating goes up and down, this would only be if they were 100% permanent total. Now, if they're 70% or greater, they can have up to $150,000 of their property tax excluded. However, this benefit would not then transfer over to their surviving spouse. And as far as how those benefits go up and down, some disabilities are not static ratings, meaning that they can change, and the VA does reevaluate certain disabilities like that, oftentimes mental health conditions or other conditions that can heal up.
Yeah, thank you.
Representative Carlson.
I was just curious because of our own family history, how it would have worked. Mm-hmm. Both of my parents have deceased quite a while. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this doesn't impact, but it would have at one time.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to point out that there's one item that the testifier didn't mention and our bill summary missed too, and that this benefit also goes to the surviving spouse of a military personnel killed in action, and this also would extend that time period from 5 years to until the spouse remarries or sells the property. So both conditions, the disabled veteran or the military personnel killed in action.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hines. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And this one, I remember when we first passed this, I ended up getting involved in a lively discussion between widows of various stripes in our community who felt like some felt they were being treated unfairly. Some were the widows of men who had died earlier, so they were not eligible to apply, even though they had the same status as someone who could apply while their husband was living, and then he died the next day, and then they get the benefit. Then there was a discussion about whether or not who was deserving, because apparently back in time, if you were determined to be diabetic after you'd entered the service, that was 100% disability, and this person went on to have a long and successful career and retired and after a very active job, actually. And then I heard from GLBT members who said, well, you know, I was together for this many years and we can't qualify. And I had one PTSD I think, challenged veteran in my district who was just so angry because he was not able to work after his service, and yet he wasn't able to help his partner with in any way with the housing contribution. And so have you as or the veterans organizations really kind of wrestled with those same issues as well? I mean, I just found myself explaining, you know, what we were able to do and what we weren't. But it really did create some tension points amongst all these people who knew each other about what's fair. And, you know, that's always a tough question.
Mr. Kreisel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, there's always going to be the gray area, and we see that. There's times that veterans come in, and we do everything we can to assist them. Sometimes they're just smack dab into that gray area, and they don't fit some of these benefits. They don't fit within the eligibility criteria. So that is a frustration. So this, in an effort of doing this, this is one step. It is a small group of people. It would be less than 10,000 overall veterans inside the state of Minnesota. But in tough times, tough budget times, what I don't want to do, what we don't want to do is really kind of be too ambitious. One step at a time, see how this works, and then possibly down the road, maybe look at some of those other items. But with the new marriage laws in Minnesota, those people would be able to most likely fit within this. As long as they should go talk to their CVSO and have them help them out. So.
Yeah. It was, Mr. Chair, it was just interesting to me that amongst the widows who were all found themselves in different circumstance, one of the things that they actually, that made the ones who were left out feel better was that it was, well, it's just 5 years. I'm not saying that's the right route to go, but I'm just saying that was, as they wrestled with this, it was really interesting how different people look at this from different perspectives.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on the bill? Mr. Schoen, welcome to the committee.
I'm Milt Schoen. I'm the Hennepin County Veteran Service Officer, and I'm the legislative chair for the County Veteran Service Officers. Our association supports this bill. There are a limited number of people affected by it, and in response to Representative Loeffler's question, I would say let's not let perfect get in the way of good. You know, oftentimes we can have issues with that. I would also point out, and I looked at the piece from the Minnesota Department of Revenue, and at first glance it would appear that this costs something. It does not cost something because people will be paying less property taxes if they apply for property tax credits on their income tax. The state will be funding less of that, and I don't know how to quantify that, but it just occurred to me when I looked at that sheet that it appeared that this would be an additional expense to the state of Minnesota. And the way I understand property taxes, and I'm just a layman, I don't think it would work that way. But it is an important help to these individuals, and I think it's something that the state has decided that is appropriate, and we'd like to tweak it. And we want to thank Representative Purcell Mr. Kreisel for supporting it.
Okay. We're going to pause for just a second. We now have quorum, so I'm going to formally start the committee, whatever the fancy language is. Convene. There we go, the Property and Local Tax Division. That does allow us. Representative Carlson, would you like to move House File 2261 for Representative Purcell to be before the committee for possible inclusion? Thank you. Ms. Schill.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, just a reminder, this is our revenue estimate and not a fiscal note. And so what you're seeing under line one where it says property tax refund interactions, that's a revenue gain. So there's not a cost to the bill, that's a revenue gain to the state.
Thank you very much. Other questions for the witnesses or the author from members? Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify regarding House 2261? Representative Runbeck, my apologies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While we're just understanding the philosophy of this bill a little bit, what is the philosophy then that the benefit would cancel if the spouse sells the house? I mean, what is the thinking there? It's 100%, right? If the widow lived in the house for the rest of her life, it would be 100% property tax exclusion. But what's the reasoning for if she sells the house that it disappears? Isn't that how it reads?
Mr. Schoen, or Mr. Schoen?
Mr. Chair, Representative Runbeck, I think the feeling was that they wanted to, when they originally did this, they wanted to quantify this, and there are average prices of homes, and if somebody's entitled to a $300,000 exclusion and they've got a $150,000 home, I don't know what the thoughts of the legislature were, but I know that when this was originally adopted, there was a lot of discussion as to what the cost would be and what the cost would be for each taxing jurisdiction and the impact on each taxing jurisdiction. And I think oftentimes the legislature wants to be cautious in what it does and put some limits on it. And you know, it may have been that to have people at whatever level of exclusion, but not having them buy a more expensive piece of property.
Mm-hmm. Representative Runbeck?
Sure. Mr. Chair, that sounds good. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair and Representative Runbeck, I was around when they were first enacting this, and just to add a little clarification, is I think the thought was that if the disabled veteran and the spouse were living in the home and the disabled veteran died, they didn't want to have there be a sudden impact on their tax situation and them suddenly to be losing this big benefit, so there was some thought to carry it over to the spouse. Mm-hmm. But that sort of logic would more deteriorate once the spouse actually changed circumstances and sold. So that was the original rationale for continuing it on to the spouse.
Sure. Thank you very much.
Last call from anyone in the audience who'd like to testify either for or against House File 2261. Sir, Mr. Schoen, if you can make some space.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Mr. Peterson, welcome back to the committee.
My name is Mark Peterson. I'm employed as a Cass County Assessor, and I'm here representing the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. And our organization is in opposition to this bill. And our objection is purely from an administrative perspective. And be assured, MAO is not opposed to creating property tax relief for disabled veterans and their surviving spouses, but we feel that this bill is unfavorable to property tax administrators for the following reasons, and I'll refer to our MAO position statement. MAO believes adjustments to market values, such as limitations on assessors' estimated market values, acquisition values, deferments, exclusions, or exemptions, creates inequities between taxpayers. Assessments should be accountable and justifiable with similar properties, and they should be understandable and transparent to the taxpayers. Good tax policy treats all taxpayers in a consistent manner, and MAO opposes classifications or programs that target only small members of taxpayers. Assessors value property, not the people that live in those properties. There are administrative complexities involved with tracking people's lifestyles, trying to determine if they've been remarried, so on and so forth. Many taxpayers question the tax inconsistencies from assessment data that is displayed on the internet, and any value exclusions also shift the burden from one property to another property class. In closing, MAO encourages the continued use of state-administered programs such as the property tax refund program, special targeting refunds, the income tax system, if policymakers wish to grant additional tax relief to certain taxpayers. And I would refer back also to the property tax working group's results that came out in 2012 for simplification of the property tax system, and that involved eliminating some classifications and consolidating some classifications and not expanding classifications. And MAO's position statement holds to that philosophy. Also, we would like to simplify the system and not make it more complex.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Peterson? Seeing none, Representative Purcell, any last comments?
Just appreciate your consideration, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. House File 2261 is laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. While we're at this, the chair will move that House File 2426 be before the committee for possible inclusion in the division report. And the chair will move the H2426A1 amendment to get the bill in the condition that Representative Dill prefers. Any discussion of the amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. House File 2426 is laid over for possible inclusion in the division report. Representative Anzels, thank you for your patience, sir. Representative Lean, would you like to move House File 2399 to be before the committee for possible inclusion in the division report?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Lean. Representative Anzels, welcome.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm here this afternoon at the request of my community of Cohasset, community that is the host community for the Clay Boswell Electric Generating Facility operated by Minnesota Power. And I have a bill that is supported by the Coalition of Utility Cities, of which Cohasset is one. And I'm joined here at the witness table by Amanda Dewar, who represents the Coalition of Utility Cities. To begin with, electric power generating facilities throughout Minnesota are eligible for something called a sliding scale exclusion, which in layperson's terms results in a significant reduction in their market value, which negatively can affect host communities. It's that negative effect of the sliding scale exclusion that I'm trying to prevent here, so my community of Cohasset does not lose a significant amount of their net tax capacity. Now, the exclusion is available to power companies when they convert to more efficient energy operations that provide greater efficiency. And typically, the conversion is from coal to natural gas. And so Minnesota Power is the plant in question here. The community is Cohasset. No. I'm told that Minnesota Power is neutral on the bill. Both Ms. Dewar and I will stand for questions if you have any.
Right. Ms. Dewar, do you have comments you wish to share with the committee? Welcome.
I do. Thank you.
Please state your name and then proceed.
Amanda Dewar, representing the Coalition of Utility Cities. Thank you very much. The Coalition of Utility Cities is an organization of seven cities that host power plants in their communities. First, I'll provide a brief background on the sliding scale exclusion. It was originally passed into law back in 1996 for a specific cogeneration project for coke refineries, though the statute, which is 272.0211, is worded more generally. The efficiency and market value exclusion rates were then updated again in 2005. The owner or operator of the electric generation facility may apply for an 8% market value exclusion for every point of efficiency that the plant operates above 40%. And though the statute suggests that the exclusion is for non-utility-owned facilities and cogeneration projects, over time, utilities have applied for and been granted the sliding scale exclusion. They apply with the Department of Commerce, which then asks the Department of Commerce to determine the efficiency of the facility. I provided in the handouts members with a copy of a memo from the Department of Commerce, which acknowledges that the governing statute implies that the sliding scale exclusion is meant for non-utilities. And I'm going to read some of the excerpts from that, from the memo. The emphasis on cogeneration projects is apparent. Also, the language of the statute appears to assume that the electric generation facility would be owned by a non-utility rather than a public utility, goes on to say. In this case, the project will not be constructed as a cogeneration facility, nor will it be owned by a non-utility. The electricity will not be owned by an industrial customer and resold to the local public utility as envisioned by the statute. While the circumstances are somewhat different than those which may have been envisioned by the statute, similar projects have been analyzed and received exemptions in the past. I've also included a staff analysis from the Public Utilities Commission, which signs off on the sale of electricity when facilities receive this exclusion, which questioned whether facilities directly owned by a utility meet the qualifications for a sliding scale exclusion. The memo says, based on the review of the statute and legislative history, there is not a clear indication that the exemption was intended to apply to situations where utilities owned the generating facility. However, again, based on general intent, the project and exclusion was eventually approved. So the bill before you today is being brought forward as a preemptive measure. In the past, like Representative Anzell said, it's often when plants have been converted from coal to natural gas that the utility then applies for the sliding scale exclusion. And like he said, currently the Boswell plant in Cohasset and also the Laskin plant in White Lakes are undergoing conversions right now from coal to natural gas. Other natural gas facilities that have applied for and received this exemption operate at about 49% efficiency. So if you take that 8% per point of efficiency for every point over 40%, that ends up being a 72% market value exclusion that is then applied to these facilities. And that 72% that then is excluded from the local property tax. And we modeled these numbers for Cohasset, which could result in a $3.9 million hit to the city's tax capacity. White Lakes has a smaller facility, but our modeling there shows a potential $367,000 reduction in their tax capacity if the sliding scale exclusion were to be used there. Other taxing jurisdictions, such as counties and school districts, would also be negatively affected by this exclusion. And like the committee suggested yesterday in its discussion of property tax classification, the application of the sliding scale exclusion results in the tax burden being shifted to other properties. For these reasons, and because the sliding scale exclusion is arguably not being applied in the way that reflects the original legislative intent, the Coalition of Utility Cities is proposing that only projects currently receiving it continue to be eligible for the exclusion, and that the sliding scale exclusion not be offered for future projects. So this bill would not be a tax increase on anyone, as the intent is to allow there's six currently out there facilities throughout the state that receive this. They could continue to receive the sliding scale exclusion, but moving forward, it would not be offered as a exclusion. We're simply trying to protect the budgets in the cities that host these power plants.
Thank you very much. Questions for the author of the testifier? Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify regarding Mr. Evans? Please come down, introduce yourself for the tape, and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Rick Evans with XL Energy. I have a handout I'd like to provide to the committee if I could. Make sure I save myself one. Thank you. Mr. Chair, I want to start off by putting the bill today in a little context. Utility companies pay commercial industrial property taxes on all of their land and buildings, just like other property taxpayers. We pay the state general tax on our land and buildings, just like any other business, industrial business, any other industrial facility. However, unlike most other industrial facilities, we also pay tax on our personal property. The equipment and machinery that is in our property, that is in our plants. The vast majority of other industrial facilities do not pay taxes on their personal property. And so it's important to understand that the exemption, the sliding scale exemption that's the subject of this bill, is not an exemption from the real property tax that we pay like every other business. This is an exemption from the personal property tax that virtually only utilities pay. The chart that I handed out illustrates the extent of this personal property tax. The bottom line that runs across the bottom of the chart are the real property taxes that we pay. This is for Xcel Energy, for all of our properties in the state. That's the real property tax that we pay to the communities where our real property is located. And that is not affected in any way by the sliding scale exemption. The sliding scale exemption does not exempt our property from that tax. What the sliding scale exemption exempts us from is rather the personal property tax. Now, the top line on the chart represents our total property tax payments. So the personal property taxes that we pay as a utility that most other industrial facilities would not pay is the difference, the gap between those two lines. As you can see from the chart, we pay approximately 3 to 4 times more money in personal property taxes to our host cities than a comparable facility or our facility pays in real property taxes to those cities. For example, in one of our communities where our nuclear plant is located, if we were any other kind of business with an equally valued piece of property, we would pay about $3.5 million in property taxes. As it is, we pay nearly $14 million to that community because of the personal property tax that we pay as a utility. What the chart also indicates, if you look at the tail end, is that our personal property tax payments are increasing rapidly. Now, the reason for that is simply because we're making very large investments in our plant. For example, down in our Prairie Island nuclear plant, we just installed something called a steam generator. It's a $100 million piece of equipment. There's two of them down there. When we replaced that, then the depreciated value of the old steam generator, which we were paying taxes on at a lower level, that value suddenly became $100 million. So as we make investments in our plants, which we're doing all the time, the amount of property tax, personal property tax we pay, actually can go up quite rapidly, as you see has been the case in the last several years from the chart. Since about 1993, every time we have built, or any other utility in the state of Minnesota has built, a new gas plant, a new gas generating plant, there has been a special piece of legislation in the legislature every single year, as it happens, to exempt that plant from the personal property tax. In fact, I believe there's a bill moving through the legislature this year to exempt a new gas plant from the personal property tax. The importance of that is, and I think that's happened 35 times since 1993, the importance of that fact is that the state policy has for the last 20 years or so been moving away from the personal property tax for electric generation facilities. And so our opposition to this bill is simply that now we're changing the direction. We're changing the direction of 20 years of policy by providing, essentially creating a potential for an increase in the personal property taxes that utilities pay. And then finally, the last thing I guess I'd like to point out is that, as Ms. Duer mentioned, we achieve the exemption, the sliding scale exemption, by making the plants more efficient. If we make a plant more efficient so we can create more energy with less input, that should be consistent with what the state wants us to do and encourages us to do by creating a property tax exemption for the personal property taxes paid by those facilities. So I would speak on behalf of Xcel Energy as opposed to this legislation as reversing the direction of energy policy that we think the state should go. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions from members? Representative Carlson.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I'm looking at your chart, and what the up and down here looks like it was fairly significant. So I would assume that in the early 90s, you must have made major investments, and then they dropped off. Was that due to the depreciation of the personal property tax then? And now as you're making new investments, the curve goes back up. I'm just trying to understand
sure.
the chart, the waves.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, it's a combination of a couple of things. The increase that we pay is building and improving new plants, and so that's what you see as the line increases. There were a couple of things that happened, and I probably won't get the dates right, but I can. Ms. McKiernan is here, and she'll correct me, or she can provide those. The legislature did lower the personal property tax rates as part of a tax negotiation back in the 90s. That would indicate one of those drops that you see there. The other drop has to do with a dispute between the utilities and the Department of Revenue on the method of valuating plants. The Department of Revenue was using a method to value plants that we thought was inconsistent with the statute. It was challenged in the tax court for a number of years. Every single time the tax court reversed the Department of Revenue, and finally, I think sometime back in the early 2000s, the Department of Revenue decided to change their valuation method to be consistent with what the tax court had ruled was the correct valuation method, and that's responsible for one of the other more significant drops that you see there. Other than that, it's the fact that this is a tax attached to a depreciating asset, and so every year the assets are depreciated, they become worth, they have less value, and so the tax goes down. Then when we replace them, obviously with new and expensive equipment, then the tax goes up.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions from members? Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify regarding House File 2399? Seeing none, Representative Anzels, any closing comments on House File 2399?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I do think it may be appropriate at some time in the process for a response to one investor-owned utility's position on my bill as opposed to another investor-owned utility's position on my bill, which is neutrality. I'll defer that for the time being, appreciate your attention to the bill.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Anzel. Your House File 2399 is now laid over for possible inclusion in the division
Thank
report.
Thank you very much.
Don't go yet. The chair will move House File 2432 to be before the committee for possible inclusion in the division report. I recognize you.
That's good.
It's good for both of us, don't you think?
I hope so.
Representative Anzel.
Thank you.
To your bill, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And as you can plainly see, I'm joined at the table by an old colleague and a good friend who is here representing Itasca County, which is a county that... I am privileged to represent, and they are asking this body for the approval to issue general obligation bonds to rebuild, a 35-bed county nursing home, a nursing home that ultimately will be Medicare certified, a nursing home that is in dire need in our area, and both Mr. Solberg and I are prepared to stand for questions if you have any, and it's House File 2432.
Thank you very much, Representative Anzel. Citizen Solberg.
Thank you. Lauren Solberg, representing the Itasca County area on this particular issue. The nursing home was built in requested legislation in 2003. It was rebuilt. It's a county-owned nursing home, and they asked for a general obligation bond authority at that particular time. The chair of the committee at the time was not enthused about a general obligation bond, so they suggested that Itasca County have a revenue bond instead. They accepted that. They did remodel the nursing home, and in addition to that, they also, with the hospital in Grand Rapids, was being rebuilt as well. And they didn't know, they no longer wanted to do what we called at the time CNNC, care and nursing care for rehabilitation. So an addition was added onto the nursing home as well to be able to provide that services for extended short-term care for rehabilitation purposes. Whenever you do a revenue bond, you always have to have enough, more than just enough money to be able to pay the revenue in order to get a very good rate. The nursing home is not managed by the county. It's managed by a nonprofit that they hire. They are paying off the bonds with revenue, but if they can convert to a general obligation bond, they will lower their interest rate considerable. Right now, the original bond was for $4,435,000. It is now at $3,590,000. If they are able to give the permission to change from a revenue bond to a general obligation bond, they will, over the life of the bond, which matures in 2033, they will save about $1.34 million just by lowering their interest rate. That's the purpose of the bill. It's not any additional building project or anything else, but it is to refinance those revenue bonds so that they're able to obtain a lower interest rate.
Okay. Questions from members? Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify regarding House File 2432?
Yeah, I have a question. Pardon?
Oh, Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and former Representative Solberg, it's always good to see you. And I suspect they've done this, but as someone who works in the Health and Human Services area in the legislature, you know, this industry is changing dramatically. We are exponentially soon to change our ability to have people served in their home, even beyond who we're serving right now. Assisted livings are, you know, popping up faster in Minnesota than I think anywhere else in the nation. And so, you know, I'm wondering whether or not, since this would actually be pledging the full faith and credit of the community, whether they've really done a pretty in-depth analysis of their demographics over the next 20 years. I know at one time DHS had done a study, and it showed a lot of people, how did they make the choice of where to go? And when you need extra help, you tend to move to where your kids are. And so that some rural areas have found that if their children have all moved to another community, they tend to follow their kids when their needs start to get to be greater. And so it's a big choice to put your full faith and credit versus the revenues. And do you know, have they done that kind of a analysis of their demographics so that they're pretty confident?
Mr. Solberg or Representative Ansel, my apologies.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Loeffler, great questions, great issue. Yes, this has been a long, slow slog to this point. They've done their due diligence. This 35-bed facility augments, supplements, and fits with the assisted living movement that's going on as well in our community. But these 35 beds have been deemed by the county and its consulting people that this is absolutely essential to the overall approach to this population.
And Mr. Solberg.
Mr. Chair, to just add a little bit to that, when they first took the remodeling of the nursing home and the working with the hospital for this additional service that the hospital wanted them to take, they did a very thorough analysis of that over the length of the time. In order for them to even sell a revenue bond, those questions are asked by the people who buy the revenue bonds. I think they've done their due diligence. The revenue is paying off the bonds. This will just lower that interest rate for them a great deal. I think the legislature, both the House and the Senate, passed this similar legislation when it was carried by my person who replaced me, but 3 years ago when there was a special session and everything, this got dropped out of the final mix. So we're back to try to repass that. And it, the interest is in it is to be able to save that interest rate.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It sounds like they've done the work you expect. And yeah. Unfortunately, not all cities have, and I'm hearing about some facilities that are already 70%, 80% occupied, and they're starting to run into some issues. So that's why I asked. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, we,
Mr. Loeffler,
we do not have that issue at all. It's just the opposite is what in our case. And it's kind of nice to go back to where you live, too, when you get old. I can tell you that.
Mm-hmm. Representative Carlson.
Mm-hmm. You can call me anything you want. Just don't call me late for supper.
He was also my seatmate for many years. So, but my question is there a cost? I understand the goal of lower interest mm-hmm. rates, but this is more a curiosity question, I guess. But is it is there a cost when you buy out, if you will, the people who own the appropriations bonds to replace them with general obligation bonds? You know, we have general mm-hmm. fees when we're issuing bonds, but in this case, you're going to be retiring that debt and issuing new debt. Yeah. So is there a cost there?
Mr. Solberg.
Representative Carlson, Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, I can't tell you exactly what that cost is because sometimes revenue bonds will, there'll be a cost to buy out after 5 years or a certain length of time. Everything, every revenue bond is done in a little different fashion. But I'm sure that in their analysis, when they say that the savings of from what they would save over the life of the bonds has to have that cost included in their savings.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair,
Representative Carlson,
I would assume there's a net gain over time, right. But well, I'm assuming that there probably is some cost when you buy out current bondholders.
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, I think the net gain as it is stands right now, and it's a little bit less than it was a couple of years ago, but it's $1.34 million.
After the payments.
After the payments are made.
So forth. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions from members? Anyone else in the audience wishing to testify regarding House File 2432? With that, Representative Anzell, any closing comments?
Thank you for your consideration, and thanks for listening.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you both.
It's good to be before the committee again.
It's good to have you here. Thank you very much. Representative Lean batting cleanup today, which isn't normally fifth place, but it is. Representative Lean, would you like to, move House File 2465 to be before the committee for possible inclusion in the division report?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Please proceed.
This bill, House File 2465, is dealing with a drafting error that was done in last year's local government aid, new formula and new appropriation, and this seeks to correct that error. It's looking at the aid gap percentage, and it's adjusting the formula aid to equal unmet needs. So under the 2013 law, the formula was using the certified aid, and so this seeks to use the formula aid. Basically, what would happen without this correction is as larger appropriations go into the LGA formula, those cities that are above and beyond their unmet need will be coming down faster than what was anticipated. And as smaller appropriations are put into the formula, those cities that are not hitting their unmet need are not going to come up as quickly as was initially intended. So that's the gist of the bill, and I'll certainly stand for any questions.
Questions from members? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify regarding House File 2465? Gripper of a bill, Representative Lean. Okay, with that, any closing comment?
No, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative Lean. We'll lay House File 2465 for possible inclusion in the division report.
Thank you
very much. Representative Hertas?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move that we approve the minutes from the last meeting.
Thank you very much. Any discussion? Representative Hertas moves the March 4th, 2014 minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. With that, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.